Hi folks, welcome to episode 19 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined by Bo, and this week we're going to be talking about something I've been looking forward to talking about for a long time, which is probably something I say at the beginning of everyone, the Battle of Tunis. Now, this was an event that accumulated with the sort of ending of the, near the end, pretty much the reason that the First Punic War ended, I would say. It's very, very, very close to it. And it was the end of the Roman momentum against the Carthaginians during the First Punic War. So if you're not like a history geek, then go to Wikipedia and find out what the hell we're talking about, because we're not going to be summarizing anything here. So, Bo, as I understand it, the Romans have recently defeated the Carthaginians. What year are we talking? We're talking about 265 BC, something like that, right?
That's when the First Punic War begins, but this battle is 255?
Right. So the war has
been 255.
Yeah, so the war's been raging on for a decade at this point. There have been hundreds of thousands of casualties, and it's been bloody on both sides. But the Romans have recently defeated the Carthaginian navy. Again, you can go and watch our previous episode about how the Carthaginian navy was actually crap, if you like, in your own time. And they've landed in Africa near a city called Aspis with over 100,000 men, this being 26,000 legionaries and about 90,000 sailors after defeating the Carthaginians. And so they capture the city of Aspis. They invest it, they siege it, taking vast amounts of loot and slaves. And then they're ordered by the Senate to return Sicily. I looked around and basically it seemed it was probably for supply line reasons. It's difficult supplying that many men, even though there's no opposing navy. And so a chap called Regulus, a consul called Regulus, is left with 40 ships, 15,000 infantry and 500 cavalry to winter in Africa, which must have been quite nice, really, if you're going to spend winter anywhere, you know, for the weather. Regulus himself is a veteran commander. He's not a newbie. He's previously won a triumph for defeating some Italian tribe. I can't remember which one it was off the top of my head. And he's basically got orders to cause trouble for the Carthaginians by raiding their territories and fomenting rebellions and things like that. So, is that an accurate enough summary of where we are?
Yeah, yeah, I think absolutely. This Regulus figure, he's sort of an interesting guy, don't you think? We don't get fantastic amounts of detail about him. Like, there's no life by Plutarch or anything of him. But he does seem quite interesting. And to win a triumph in these days, it's a lot harder than in sort of the classic Augustan age where it was a political thing.
Yeah.
You'd have to really genuinely be very, very good in a battle to even dream of a triumph. So, well, later in this story, he doesn't do so amazingly brilliant. So it's interesting that he must have been good, though, I think.
Yeah.
He wouldn't really have been awarded a triumph in the Republic, sort of early Republic days, without warranting it.
No, absolutely not. And he seems to have the full confidence of the Senate as well. Because it's important to note that the consuls actually matter at this point. You know, they're actually important. They're not superseded by the emperor and political appointees. They're actually elected for competence. And so he seems to have their full confidence. And like you say, you know, he must have been good. And he's left with only 15,000 infantry and 500 cavalry. And it's like, right, okay, just go cause some trouble for them, assuming that he'd be able to handle himself. And, I mean, you know, from the accounts we've got, the Roman army seemed very good even at this point. So they've got a good army and a good commander. 15,000 men is nothing to sniff at.
No.
You know,
legionaries as well. They're not just...
Yeah, they're not just auxiliaries drafted from, you know, the farms of some, you know, Italian allies or something. These are, you know, Roman citizens. They're good at what they're doing. They're veterans, they're experienced, and so they're going to cause some trouble, aren't they?
Yes. I think also it's worth saying, or something just to add slightly to what you said there about the consuls, you know, they're not sort of superseded by an emperor or anything. So that's sort of kind of important, I think, that the two consuls really were the most senior office at that point, and taken seriously. Again, in the days of the empire, early empire, being a consul was still sort of highly coveted, but it didn't really mean a great deal in like sort of the truest sense of wielding power and being able to set policy and things.
Yeah,
because at this point, it was.
A formalisation, wasn't it, of like political alliances. You know, it's like, I'll make you consul for that year and then you'll be my man somewhere else. You know, it's like political guarantees from the power politics is going on above the sort of traditional republican structures, you know. But in this day and age, these don't exist.
We should mention that...
A thing on Regulus. What I find interesting about Regulus, like you say, we don't have a huge amount of information on him, but you can you can extract the kind of character of the man from his actions. Mm. And he reminds me a lot of Varro, actually. He's very aggressive. Very aggressive. Mm-hmm. Very confident. You know, he's like, right, you know, he's clearly like, I've got a Roman army. I know how to use it. We're going to win this. I'm going to get the glory. And, you know, it's going to be more laurel wreaths, on my head. And this is interesting, I think. You know, the Romans are consistently producing these incredibly confident and aggressive generals, whereas the Carthaginians, as we'll see later on, produce terrible generals who don't know what they're doing.
I think it's a big part, certainly in ancient war, of self-confidence, self-belief, that's kind of absolutely important.
Yeah.
Without that, you're not going to get very far, it seems. There's one thing in sort of the modern world or sort of the industrial world. You want, I'm thinking sort of World War One onwards, or 19th century onwards, you're going to want really quite different specific qualities in your senior generals than what you would have in the ancient world. And in the ancient world, one of the key things was to be usually extremely aggressive, insanely aggressive. If you're not taking the initiative, your opponent will be.
Yeah.
So whereas in, say, World War One or World War Two, it's much more of a cat and mouse game. There's much more going on. You need subterfuge and all sorts of things.
Well,
not here.
I'm actually thinking sort of Wellington and Napoleon. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Because Wellington was, like, you know, famously not a highly aggressive general, and yet he ended up being the victor. You know, whereas Napoleon was famously a highly aggressive general, and of course he lost. So it was because he was outmaneuvered. You know, he ended up creating too many enemies and, you know, finding himself in a position that you just couldn't win in. And I think from that sort of point onwards, when the army scale becomes just dramatically bigger than ancient war, you know, when Napoleon's marching 1 million men into Russia and things like that, it's okay, you know, that's mad. And the ease of which men can be killed as well when you enter the age of gunpowder, you know, suddenly it's a lot easier to kill a man. So, I mean, at some point we're going to have to do an episode on just the nature of warfare and how it's changed over the eras. Because one of the things that you forget, really, is just how hard it is to kill a man who's armoured and defending himself.
Right.
It's almost impossible. Like, this guy's got a shield, he's wearing armour, and you've got a sword. Get him. It's like, well, Christ, he might get me. You know, it's a really difficult
and
job.
And he's actively trying to not be killed.
Yes, and kill you in return.
It makes a big difference.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, if you happen to get a lucky shot and point a gun and shoot someone, then they're dead. You know, it's a totally different way of waging war. And like you say, in this era, it really does reward aggressiveness. And it doesn't so much come down to actually killing the opponent. It actually comes down to outnerving them. You know, who can play chicken for long enough? And this is, again, we'll go over this in another podcast at some point, but this is something that is born out from not just the statistics of the deaths and the battles, but like various like really classic examples of it. But we'll talk about it another time.
Mm. Well, one thing I would just say briefly is this idea of being when you do and don't want to be extremely aggressive on the field.
Yeah.
There's some times in sort of the Napoleonic era or a bit before in sea engagements as navies, you were expected to be extremely aggressive. Mm. Or sometimes cavalry commanders, I'm thinking of a few different cavalry commanders from the American Civil War, that are chided or removed from office or even prosecuted for not being aggressive enough.
Right.
They really need you to be almost suicidally aggressive at the right moment.
Yeah.
When like the senior top brass say go, you know, you've got to do it.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're quite right. This Regulus does seem to, he's not holding back.
No, he's great fun.
He's not. yeah. He has confidence in his own abilities, which having won a triumph earlier, I mean, they're quite rare. They're quite rare.
He must have known what he was doing.
Yeah. They wouldn't just give them out willy-nilly. Not that they ever did, but they became...
Thanks, Windows.
Sorry about that. I thought I'd muted.
Don't worry about that.
It's muted now. So, there were two consuls. The other one was Lucius. And for some reason, the powers that be, the Senate back in Rome, sent a letter to them saying...
come home.
Half of you stay there, sort of hold the fort for the winter, and the others come back. So they decide that the Lucius guy will come back, but Regulus, I suppose, being it's not Polybius doesn't explicitly say, but you can just imagine he's the more senior or the more seasoned one of the two. Yeah. So if
I mean, as far as we know, Lucius hadn't won a triumph.
So Polybius doesn't say that. Oh, real quick, just to say this is Polybius mainly is the best source for this, isn't it? We've got Diodorus, but it's mainly Polybius, really.
So yeah, so Regulus being left to his own devices with a significant force in Africa moves on another city called Addis, which I know, for anyone who's not familiar with Carthaginian geography, well, welcome to the club. But these are all very, very close to Carthage. Like, he's within about 30 miles at most, at the most extreme point. So the Carthaginians, you know, if they're looking from the battlements, they might be able to see the cities that he's sieging, you know, in the distance. Mm. So anyway, yeah, he moves on Addis. And so the Carthaginians recall the general they have in Sicily called Hamilcar. Not Hamilcar Barca, though, is it? No. So it's just another Carthaginian general called Hamilcar. Because the Carthaginians have got five names. But he's got 5,000 men and 500 cavalry, and so they recall him back. And they order him to go and engage Regulus. I assume he gets some extra forces at the time, but it's not clear, is it?
So. Yeah, it's not clear. Actually, that was one of the things I wanted to say. When you read Polybius, I've read it half a dozen times, I suppose, in my life, and a couple of times in the last week for this. And there's still bits, there's still a few lines where I'm like, what are you? What does that mean? What are you saying there? You're not painting a clear picture for me here. So, I mean, that's not uncommon for the ancient historians. Quite often you'll read something, you're like, you said the opposite one page ago, or that whole sentence doesn't really make sense, what you're saying there. Nevertheless, I think the picture here, when Regulus and the Romans are in North Africa in 255, it's not perfectly clear exactly what's going on and where, but although it largely is. One of the things I would say about, well, you mentioned Carthaginian geography, welcome to the club, that it's not clear. Absolutely, that's quite a funny, interesting, good point to make, because for most of my life, I've always thought of, had really quite a low resolution idea in my mind of the topography around Carthage and Tunisia. It's easy to think that there's just this one giant city, Carthage, sitting there on the plain near the coast, near-ish the coast, and that's it. But the reality, of course, is much more complicated than that, isn't it? And when you start reading, if you start reading stuff, Plutarch, from the Second Punic War, and there's lots of, quite a few different battles at different points go on in North Africa, don't they? Yeah. So here, this one is sort of our first foray into the Romans being in North Africa near Carthage and sort of actions going down there. Anyway, what the picture I get from Polybius is that you've got obviously the main city of Carthage, which is walled, and then there's sort of satellite towns around it. Is that the impression you get?
That is definitely the impression I get.
And that they're not walled.
Some are. I guess the more important ones are, but a lot of them aren't. And I would guess that's down to the fact that really, very little action actually ever occurs in Africa from like a historical military perspective. Like, the Athenians are planning to go and conquer Carthage, but the only Greek I can think of that ever actually landed an army in Africa was Agathocles of Syracuse.
Right. Okay.
He's literally the only one I can think of. Like, Pyrrhus planned it, Alexander plans it, the Athenians plan it, but no one ever does it. And so, the Carthaginians have got like the Numidians and things, you know, Mantians or whoever to worry about, but they're not the same. You know, they're horsemen. They don't have like, you know, tons of infantry and siege equipment, basically, which is what you need to take a city. So I doubt they had too much problems with the issue of cities being raided. So I can imagine that their defences weren't fantastic, frankly.
And at this point in this particular war, you would think, although again, I can't remember a line where Polybius explicitly says this, but it's sort of there, that the Carthaginians they weren't ready for it. We didn't really expect Rome to do that.
No.
I think that's interesting. Quite often in different wars, one side will start a war and then end up losing it. Yeah. For example, the thing that's in my mind is the Japanese declare war on America in the Pacific and they end up getting their asses handed to them in no uncertain terms. And they just wouldn't have... when they first decided on that, they wouldn't really have... You wouldn't think they'd really dream of firestorms consuming Tokyo.
No, that's probably not what they were thinking. Wasn't there one admiral who was like, look, we've awakened a sleeping dragon here?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, there were at least some voices who were like, this is not going to end well.
Yeah. Actually, just a quick aside on that it seems the Japanese were fully aware that they were biting off more than they could chew. It's weird. The psychology of that is weird.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.